Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What is happening, gang? We are live on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and in today's episode, we're switching it up a little bit. So the last couple weeks, we've been looking at players who Bill was involved with who are actually in the Hall of Fame. In this week's episode, we begin our two-part look at making the case for two players who Bill was heavily involved with throughout their careers who definitely should be in Canton. So today, we're going to look at Steve Tasker. Next week, we're going to look at Reggie Wayne. This is part one of making that case. We're also going to look at sort of the special teams landscape as a whole, how special teams players have been evaluated, you know, historically from a Hall of Fame perspective. And we're going to look at two interesting other options in Devin Hester and Brian Mitchell and see if those guys meet the criteria for Bill to be Hall of Famers. But before we dive into today's show, I want to take a minute to talk about one of our favorite sponsors on the pod, BetOnline. If you're into sports betting, BetOnline is where you should go to win money today. Whether it's live bets during games or futures for who you think will win the championships, BetOnline has all the latest odds, news, and information for all your online sports betting needs. So visit the website today or use your mobile device to join and receive your 50% off welcome bonus on your first deposit. 50% off on your first deposit. So before we get to the next big game, head over to BetOnline and start playing today. All right, guys, this is fun. This is part one of our look at making the case for the Hall of Fame, and we're going to go deep into Steve Tasker. All right, here we go. All right, we are live on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. Rick has got a collared shirt on. His hair is combed. It's 10:30 in the morning. Something must be unusual. How are we doing today, guys?
We're doing well. Scott, you being such a maven of style, yes. I figured it was time for me to up my game as you stand there. You know, Scott doesn't have to worry about combing his hair. There's no collar anywhere near his shirt, anywhere in the room. But, okay, go ahead.
Totally good. I might have slept in this shirt. So I don't know if you've heard, but apparently former NBA player Lamar Odom may be returning to professional basketball soon in Spain. I was reading a press release about how he started taking a pH balancing alkaline supplement called Balance 7, and that's what helped him bounce back from his hospitalization in 2015. He even said, "I have an enormous amount of energy, which is good for me. It's important when working out. I always need energy to level up." Couldn't agree more with Lamar, and after watching him fight in that boxing match against Eric Carter in July, I think it's safe to say Balance 7 is working for him. Cool thing is, we've got a promotion running with Balance 7 right now, where if you go to their website, balance7.com, and use the code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, at checkout, you'll receive a free 4-ounce bottle of My Smooth Skin with any purchase of Balance 7 products. That product retails for $13.99, so I'd say it's worth it. Again, head to balance7.com and use the code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, at checkout to get in on the promotion. I know you will. If it worked for him, it can work for you too. All right. Well, today we shift a little bit. So the last few weeks, we've looked at obviously some of the Hall of Fame careers Bill has been a part of. Now we're going to begin to make the case. And so we're going to look at two particular players in the next 2 weeks, Steve Tasker and Reggie Wayne. And we're going to begin this week with Steve Tasker. But before we dive into Tasker, we've got to kind of set the stage and the environment for special teams in the NFL and how special teams players are viewed from a Hall of Fame standpoint. So without further ado, Rick, dive us in.
Okay. Bill, let's even start a little bit more basically. you've touched on this in the past in different ways, but, you know, talk about, if you would, within the game of professional football, the importance of special teams and how they can change the outcome.
Well, professional football is about yardage and points. And I'm borrowing from Bill Parcells here, but it's one of the most basic tenets that he articulated, which I absolutely subscribe to. And I don't want to get into a metric argument because I'm the least qualified person to deal with math, and I hate it to begin with. So what is believed and what is true, what we know as football people are true, is that, you know, yardage accumulated, field position, if you will, which is an old school term, directly affects scoring. So basically, 7 to 10 yards, depending upon it. Now it's closer to 10 because of the nature of the passing game. Basically equals 1 point. But let's go back to the old rule of thumb and say, you know, 7 yards equals 1 point. Starting field position, without question, no matter what metric, no matter what equation you use, starting field position leads to scores. So if you start below your 20-yard line, what we call the minus 19 down to the goal line, minus territory, the chances of scoring reduce dramatically. For every yard past your 20, they increase. The reason that we put the touchback rule in and moved it to the 25-yard line was to discourage kickoff returns. Now, you know, for every action, there's an opposite reaction. Coaches, Bill Belichick leading the way, a former special teams coach, decided that if you could pooch kick the ball, a dynamic pooch kick, which would come down somewhere between the goal line and the 5-yard line, you could affect starting position. The original Parcells disciple. He's trying to kick the ball down to the 2 or 3 yard line, make you return it. And as a result, have you start out at the -7, -8, somewhere in there. And that reduces your ability to score dramatically. Over the course of a season, it reduces it dramatically. So special teams not only control points in terms of field goals and extra points if you kick them, but in the punting game and now in the kickoff game, where kickers have become so adept at doing all of these various types of kicks, you control field position completely. And a player, a coverage player, who can win consistently and who can affect field position because he can maneuver his body to down the ball, he can make tackles in the open field, he can avoid blockers at the line of scrimmage and create fair catches, is worth his weight in gold. And there are only two in the history of the game, since we know that the kicking game was not as important in the from about 1935 on until, oh, let's say 1985. There are only two to think about. Slater, who's still playing with the New England Patriots, who plays no position. He doesn't have a position, actually. I think they list him as a wide receiver or maybe a DB, but he never plays there. And Steve Tasker, who preceded him. There are only two.
Right.
All others are pretenders. So those two persons are unique in the history of football. There were some guys who preceded them, wedge busters and things like that, you know, when the rules were different. But these two guys are in a class by themselves in terms of Pro Bowls in their career. In Steve Tasker's case, MVP of the Pro Bowl, I think twice. they change games. And essentially, if you think about it, what is the ultimate definition of a Hall of Famer? A guy who changes games, a difference maker. If he's not a difference maker, then he better be a guy like Frank Gore with incredible longevity and incredible production if he's not a difference maker. It's that simple. If you take away all the crap that surrounds and all the electioneering and all the nonsense that surrounds candidacies, is the guy a difference maker? Put another way, and I've said this in the room, I walked softly as a rookie last year, but I'm going to be a little more vociferous this time around. I don't want to hear about stories. I don't want to hear what a great guy he was. I don't want to hear how he worked so hard to develop his craft. I don't want to hear any of that stuff. Tell me, did we have to game plan against him? Start there. And if the answer is no, then he's not a Hall of Famer.
Not on the list.
Not on the list.
Right.
So, Bill, to that end, before we dive into Steve in greater detail, in terms of sort of two Hall of Fame guys from a special teams perspective that come into my mind, and just to me, it's amazing how we haven't put more emphasis on this, would be somebody like a Brian Mitchell or a Devin Hester, who it seems to me those are guys that you would have to game plan for from a special teams perspective and not in the Hall of Fame yet.
Yeah, without question. The only real return man that's in the Hall of Fame, Deion is a combination guy.
Right.
Deion didn't tackle, but he did everything else. The only real genuine return guy, and he was also a great running back, is Gale Sayers. There are really no other return people in the Hall of Fame. And why was special teams, including kickers, until John Stenerud was put in, why were they neglected? Because there was a cabal of people among the voting group who thought that special teams weren't important. And that's it. That's just a very simple answer. So now more and more people recognize and more football people preach, starting with Marv Levy, by the way, and Vic Vermeil, who was just who's going to be elected this coming January, they were the first two special teams coaches in NFL history, and they became successful head coaches and preached the gospel of special teams, which was carried on by Belichick and others, and now special teams has become a major factor in the game. So selectors have to honor it. I mean, they simply can't ignore it and give it the back of their hands. So special teams players become people who get consideration. In the case of Mitchell, he's got a really good case because he had longevity, 14 years. He had outstanding production. He's on top of the list in both kick and punt return yardage. His non-return yardage is negligible. It wouldn't qualify him under any circumstances. We'd have to look at Sproles in relation to Mitchell, but Sproles is a little like Gale. You know, he's a mini version of Gale Sayers. Longevity. Gale didn't have longevity, but he's had longevity. He's got ball handling skills, he's runner, receiver, returner. He's a different cat. But Hester and Mitchell will be looked upon as strictly returners. And I would give no credence and shout down, 3,000 and some yards that were gained from scrimmage. That doesn't qualify him. I mean, it wouldn't even talk about him under those circumstances. So throw it out. There's no added value there. And so now you're comparing Mitchell, who played 14 years, and Hester, who played 11, relative to total yardage and touchdowns and yards per kick. You start with the premise that they had to be game planned against, and I certainly can attest to that with respect to Hester in Super Bowl 41.
Yeah, we know that one well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they passed the first test. They had to be game planned against. They were difference makers who changed games. Now let's talk about what their production was relative to one another. And no stories. We don't want to hear where they came from. We don't care who their high school coach was. You know, we don't care what they did in the community. None of that counts. So that's how I would frame that argument. And I will, when the time comes, I started out as actually coach special teams in Canada and started out at the college level coaching special teams. So I got a little background in it, and that's how I'm going to frame the argument.
You know, another way to show how hard it's been for special teams to be recognized is the fact that, you know, the more obvious, the overt ones are certainly kickers. And, you know, in the only guys out of the whole history of the league, you know, who have made it in are George Blanda, who, of course, was, as more up to me, a quarterback. You got Adam Vinatieri. You got Jan Stenerud. You got Steven Guskowski. You got Gary Anderson, Jason Hansen, Jason Elam, and Matt Stover. And then the only punter is Ray Guy. So
none of those guys are in.
None of those guys are in.
No, yeah. What about the guys who it's obvious, Bill, with kicking and punting and so on and so forth?
Well, you got Jan, who had a long career and held all the records for a period of time. You got his Morton, who held all the records, surpassed all of Jan's records. And now you'll have Vinny, who has surpassed all of Morton's records. So the leading kicker of all time at the time he's eligible likely will get in.
Right.
Assuming he's had an outstanding clutch kicking record, which, you know, you could argue that Morton really didn't, but he had, you know, really phenomenal statistics and certainly was, you know, good enough. And you know, Vinny holds the record for Super Bowls among kickers.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a resume that's, it's hard to put up against anybody ever at any position.
A kicker won't be a first ballot selectee, but it won't be long after that. And it would depend on the year that Vinny's eligible, you know, who else is on the ballot too.
But the problem also that Vinny set forth is, how do you beat that? I mean,
no one will.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this is impossible.
So what? Yeah. You know, I would argue that Hansen might have a good case, but he doesn't come near Vinny in terms of numbers and championships and all the rest of that. That's what the Hall of Fame's all about.
Right.
Everybody. No. Peter King once said, and it sounds condescending, but I know he didn't mean it that way. A Hall of Fame is not the Hall of the Good. It's the Hall of the Great. And there were a lot of good kickers. Baltimore's guy, when he's finished,
yeah,
will have a case. But there ain't a lot of Super Bowls there. And you know, where will he be relative to Vinny when it's all said and done? I don't know. There's no one else to challenge it. Guskowski doesn't, he's got Super Bowls, but not the, neither the longevity nor the numbers. And so, you know, Vinny's, for the time being, or maybe for the foreseeable future, Vinny's the only one. And that's probably the way it should be.
Yeah. No, he might have locked the door.
Well, you know, I would make a case for the guy who's now kicking in Baltimore.
We'll see. He's still playing. He's still playing.
Got a ways to go.
All right. I mean, and okay, we're on track for something else here. So let's.
All right. Let's dive into Tasker.
One thing we're not going to do is anoint guys who are still playing.
Right.
Let's leave that to the broadcasters. Okay.
Let's let that go.
Okay. We'll leave that to the sound machine that's out there. All right. Okay. So not now. What I'm going to say now is a little bit of a story, Bill, but it's just his background. Okay. So Stephen J. Tasker was born on April 10th, 1962, he was, you know, initially overlooked when it came to his college days by all the big boys. So he began his football career at Dodge City Community College. After 2 years, he transferred to Northwestern. And here's the kind of athlete he was. After finishing his football days there, and before he was drafted in the NFL, he decided to sign up for the Northwestern's rugby team. He had never played rugby before, and he ended up being voted the most valuable player in the Big Ten rugby league. So, I mean, the guy was really an amazing athlete. And he also still continues to hold Northwestern's all-time career return average on kickoffs. So let's go back to the 1985 draft. With the first pick in the round, the Bills selected Glenn Jones, a defensive back from Norfolk State. And with the very next pick, the Houston Oilers took Steve Tasker. As history will tell us, Norfolk State was the last place Glenn Jones ever played a organized football game. And Steve Tasker was, well, Steve Tasker. Now, Bill, at that point, you were the Bills' pro personnel director, so you had no role in that decision. So I feel comfortable in saying that the Bills passing on Tasker for Jones puts me in mind of something that Blaine Nye, the erudite former offensive guard for Stanford and Dallas, once said, which was, it's not whether you win or lose it counts, it's who gets the blame. Bill, who screwed up? How come they didn't take Tasker?
Well, that's an unanswerable question. You know, the draft doesn't work that way. If you could predict who going to turn out to be great, you'd be paid zillions by some NFL team to do it. It's just an unanswerable question.
All right.
I knew a little about Steve Tasker, which I volunteered during the pre-draft process, because I had been in the USFL with the Chicago Blitz. And this is important in terms of how Steve ultimately got to the Bills. Northwestern was one of our protected schools, meaning that any player from Northwestern was automatically our property. So myself, John Butler, who was the Blitz assistant personnel director, and later I was GM and John was the personnel director, and Marv Levy, the head coach for whom we both worked, knew a lot about Steve Tasker because we knew a lot about the Northwestern players. And we talked to Denny Green, who was then the coach. We'd seen him play, et cetera. And he was 5'10", 185. So not a guy that, you know, would jump at you with height, weight. He did have speed. There's no question about that. He ran fast. And he had really great quickness and was a great collegiate player, but not somebody that, you know, in those days, particularly if a personnel department didn't value special teams, and there were no slot receivers, you would say to yourself, you know, where's this guy play? You know, what does he do for us?
That Matt Slater question.
Yeah. At a later time in Steve and our careers, Mark Levy and I thought differently. So it turned out differently. But at that time, you know, it was not a guy that you'd give heavy consideration to.
Mm-hmm. So he ends up spending that 85 season there at Houston, and they cut him before the 10th game of the 86 season. And you are the GM of the Bills at this point, and that's when you took him. Given everything you knew at that point, in your mind, were you, and he had played really no wide receiver while he was in Houston, had you already made the decision that this was somebody in your mind who could help on special teams and was worthy of a roster slot there, or was it still sort of a special teams, general offensive player kind of thing?
No. We had a very specific role in mind for him. And here's the background of it. Marv, of course, had studied him closely when he was when we were all with the Blitz. So we knew Steve well. He was a player we really liked. We would have had the league, had the USFL gone forward, it's likely that he would have signed with the Blitz, thanks to our former president who went under, but and went dark, and then subsequently went under. So there was no place for him to sign, but he would have signed with the Blitz without question. Probably been the first guy they'd sign. So we, the three of us, John Butler, Bill Pulley, and Marv Levy, knew him well and loved him. We were, the Bills were getting ready to trade for Pete Metzelaar as a tight end who had been in, who was in Seattle. And the week before we were going to consummate the trade, my boss, Norm Pollum, sent me to see Seattle versus Houston in Seattle in the preseason to make sure that that Pete Metzelaar got through the game healthy before we consummated the trade. He wanted eyes on him to be sure that he was going to be healthy. In the course of seeing that game, I saw for the first time Steve Tasker do in the National Football League for Houston what he did for us for all those years. So I put a big red line under his name in the, on my flip card, and put in a report which basically said, if he comes on the wire, let's claim him for sure. And maybe let's think about trading for him. Now, Hank Bulla wasn't interested in trading for him, but at some point in time, I thought he was certainly well worth a waiver claim. He also played some receiver in that game and did well. I mean, he was quick. He could get open. He had really good hands, all that stuff. So I come back. Pete makes it through the game fine. We make the trade. And now Steve goes on injured reserve during the 86 season. And now in those days, if a player was on injured reserve for a period of time, 6 weeks, I think it was, you could bring him back. Number one, you could practice him when he was healthy. And number two, you could bring him back as long as he went through waivers. So there was an unwritten rule that said you don't claim a guy coming off injured reserve. You know, you just don't do it. And everyone was well aware of it. It wasn't cricket, really.
Right.
So Steve Tasker on a Friday, I believe, which is when you waive guys that you're trying to get through. You don't want anybody else to claim them, and they probably won't because they've got their roster set and, you know, the game plan's in and the coach doesn't want to hear about a claim and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Steve Tasker pops up on the waiver wire. It's in, as I recall, in late October or early November.
In November, yeah.
And so I see his name. John Butler was out scouting, I think. I see his name and I take my copy of the waiver wire and head down the hall. And it was probably a 25-yard difference between my office at one end of the building and Marv's on the other. And we meet in the middle because Marv's coming to my office with the same waiver wire. And he said, "You see Tasker's name?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Claim him." I said, "Okay." I was coming to ask you the same thing.
Yeah.
So we put the claim in, and we got him. And the general manager of the Oilers, Mike Hollaback, who was one of the great people that God ever put on this earth, was so furious with me for making the claim that he called me and really ripped me. And for Mike Hollaback to rip someone, I mean, you better be in Charles Manson's league. You had to be at the top of the bed, guy. And I felt terrible. I felt terrible because I had such high regard for Mike. But I said, "Mike, look, we're at the bottom of the barrel. I'm sorry. I know what the unwritten rule is. I know what you're not supposed to do. And I know you're mad, but we don't, you know, we're trying to survive here.
Trying to win three games.
Yeah.
Trying to win four. I mean, come on.
Yeah, we're trying to win three games once.
Yes.
In 4 years, you know. And so he was mad. He hung up the phone. And then the following winter at the league meetings, following spring at the league meetings, he came over to me and apologized. I said, "You didn't need to apologize, for God's sake. You had every right to rip me." And he said, "Well, one thing's for sure, you got a great player." and so Steve shows up. He drives from, he wasn't going to play the game that weekend, that's for sure, because it was late in the week. So we called him and said, he said, "Can I drive up?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." So he drove, and he drove up in a Volkswagen bus, which was, semi-psychedelic at a time. Now, we have younger listeners who won't recognize that term or even know what it's describing.
It's coming back, Bill. No, I think they will.
Bill's making a reference to the Merry Pranksters, who drove that Volkswagen bus cross country, and you can listen to the name Jack Kerouac. So.
Everything that's old is new again. There's a whole new psychedelic generation, Bill.
Okay. Well, it was semi-psychedelic, as I remember, and it was old and beat up. That was for sure. And so he pulls into the parking lot, and if I'm not mistaken, the guard called my office and said, "There's a guy down here that says he's a player and he's here to talk to you." I said, "Well, who is it? What's his name?" Said, "It's Tasker, but this guy's not a player. He's like a guy." I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll be right down." So I came down and I said hello, and his wife, Sarah, got out of the car. Now, how many years ago it is? I don't know. It's close to, it's 40 at least, I guess. Yeah. Sarah doesn't look 35 today. She looked about 14 then. And he introduced me to her. Years later, I kidded him about it. I said, "Have you ever heard of the Mann Act?" And he said, "No, I don't think so." And I said, "That's the first thing that came to my mind. There's a law in New York State that said you cannot transport underage females
across state lines."
Across state lines. And I thought, "Oh my God, it's a good thing a state trooper didn't pull this guy over. They would have had to produce their marriage certificate." But Sarah is a wonderful person. And as I say, to this day, the youngest looking person I've ever come across. But and that's the way she looked then. So here's this young couple joining our team. And of course, Marv knew exactly how he wanted to use Steve. And as time went on, he exceeded even Marv's expectations. As time went on, even though he worked out with the wide receivers, he went through all the wide receiver drills and everything, was listed as a wide receiver, Marv wouldn't play him in a game because he was too afraid of getting him hurt and losing him on special teams. And the same is true of returns. When the game was on the line and we had to catch a punt or needed a punt return to set up field position in a big, important game, he would use Steve to do that, but not as the regular punt return, because he did not want to get him hurt. And the late Nick Nicolau, God rest his soul, the receiver coach, was so annoyed that he couldn't use Steve as a receiver, he would almost ignore him in the drills, and he'd always grouse about it. Said, "I don't know why I got this guy. I can't even use him in drills." And Marv wouldn't budge.
Yeah.
So, but Steve became a unicorn, to use today's phrase. There was no one like him in the game. Baltimore had a kid that was in the Canadian League briefly and then came down, whose name escapes me. He's a contracted ALS and had a short career.
Steve Gleason?
No, not Steve Gleason. No, Steve's another story entirely. We drafted Steve. and I forget whether it was, or signed him as a free agent. I forget. It went Buffalo, I think, or maybe Carolina. but
O.J. Bergantz.
O.J. Bergantz, yeah. O.J. Bergantz was the closest, that came closest to Steve, but you know, unfortunately developed the disease and had a short career, but beyond that was not quite as good as Steve. Steve could do everything on special teams, and he was pound for pound the greatest athlete on our team. Now, his nickname was Seve, as in Seve Ballesteros.
Okay.
Because he could drive the golf ball longer than anybody on the team. He had the best short game of anybody on the team. He could do anything athletically. I've told this story 100 times, but it bears repeating. 3 or 4 years forward, when he had established himself as a star in the National Football League, he was doing a commercial. And he now represents a series of Ford dealerships in Western New York, with West Herb Ford being the most notable one, and has since his playing days. But this was for another company. And the commercial involved him doing a standing backflip and landing on his feet. And I to this day, I can't remember what the tagline was, but they were filming it in June during vacation time. And so I'm in my office, and I get a call again from security. There's a bunch of people out here doing a commercial, and they've gone well over time. So I said, well, who's involved? Well, we didn't, you know, security people didn't know, and our security director wasn't there. It was vacation. So I said, all right, I'll come down. So I went downstairs, and it's Steve. And they've got the whole thing set up at midfield. And, okay, let's do a take. And they do the take, and he does the backflip and lands on his feet. Not good enough. They do another take. They do another take. And now I'm saying to myself, I don't care about the equipment. I care about the best special teams player in football. Right.
Doing 45 backflips.
Yeah.
50 yards.
I went over to the director, and I said, what's going on? Well, this is a commercial, and he's got to do these backflips. And I said, yeah, but you know what? We're paying him a hell of a lot more than you are. Why do you have to have all these takes? Well, we have to get it right. He was a director, of course, right?
Yeah.
So I said, Steve, how many of these have you done? He said, I don't know, 20 or so. I said, that's enough. You got one more. If it's not good enough, to hell with it.
Exactly. He may have been the director, but you were the producer.
So Steve said, no, no, that's good. I'm okay. So he did like 4 or 5 more. Can you imagine someone doing 20 to 25 standing backflips? I mean, it's not possible. But that's why these athletes, I mean, they're the 0.001% in the National Football League. They can do these things. So it's like Steph Curry, you know, shooting from the third row in a courtside and making, you know, 10 out of 10. They can do things that human beings can't. So just an aside about his athletic ability, which was second to none on the team. In those days, the Buffalo Sabres had the French Connection line. And every one of the French Connection golfers were great golfers, and so there was a celebrity charity golf circuit around Western New York that, you know, many of us participated in during the spring and early summer before camp, and you know, you'd raise a lot of money for great charities because both teams were hot at the time, and. I'm trying to think of the name of the guy, Rick. It's immaterial. There would always be a long drive contest. And the winners, there would always be somebody who was a non-athlete who thought that he was the biggest guy in town at the club, right? At the host club.
Yeah.
So they'd get the long drive champion, the whole club. And he would go against Steve Tasker, Pete Metzelaars, and two of the guys from the French Connection. And 6 out of 7 times, Steve would win.
I bet.
And so that showed you I mean, he was an absolutely unique athlete. In terms of what he did for us, A, did you have to game plan against him? Yes. He didn't play a half a season before everyone in the league was double teaming him on punt coverage. And we would often move him around, put him in motion, things like that, so they couldn't double him. But even when he was double, he would routinely be double teamed. Routinely. You know how people these days, the rule is you can't run out of bounds to avoid a double team and then come back in and make the play.
Right.
He never had to go out of bounds. He would just juke the guys out of his shoes or run or explode right through them. And he was a devastating open field tackle. On kickoff coverage, he could not be blocked. I don't know that they kept statistics, but I doubt that anybody came close to him in tackles on kickoffs. And he was absolutely adept at causing fumbles by returners. Untold amount of fumbles that he caused, that he tomahawked out of there because he was able to put his hat right on the ball or he was able to tomahawk it out. He saved touchdowns because of his speed. He was not a safety man, but if the play got out the other side, he would track it down. But we had coverage patterns both on punts and kickoffs that no one ever saw before because we'd run them across the whole field. He'd start off at L3 and end up at R1 because there was a tendency to return against him, and he'd make the play. I mean, we'd actually create a hole for him so he could make the play. He changed games. Marv constantly practiced every day or every other day in training camp and once a week during the regular season in blocking kicks. I won't go into the whole technique, but he had a unique technique and a unique way of doing it based on geometry, which I'll finish this thought and get to the story. You had to block the kick at the point where it exited the kicker's foot, the kick point, so-called block point, which was 2.5 yards or 3 yards, depending on the stride of the kicker, that we would measure it every week, from his alignment point. And you had to block it off his foot. You could not block it in the air. It's not possible. Can't do it. Marv had done studies on it. So you had to come at the block point, not the kicker, to avoid roughing the kicker. We never got a roughing the kicker penalty.
Right.
And you had to extend your hands through the block point. So if you put your hands together, thumbs together, right, index fingers together, your arms at your side, you then shot your arms forward and down toward the ground. It's completely non-traditional, right? Most people think I block the kick by putting my hands up. No, you block your kick by putting your hands down. It's an unnatural thing. You have to learn.
Yeah.
You don't do it that way. Even in the colleges today, they don't know how to teach it. At the best colleges, they don't know how to teach it. And you have to work on it. And Marv had drills where we would do it with little beach balls and things like that, so that players would get used to having dexterity in their hands, so that the ball, when you blocked it, went back toward the other team's goal line and not out of bounds. So Steve could do all of that. He not only could get around the corner, in some cases a double team, to get to the block point. He was always at the right block point. And he had the touch of a tennis player in blocking the kick.
Wow, yeah.
He could direct the ball. Unheard of. And there's no one that's ever done it since, in my understanding. So these were skills that no one else had. Now, do Hall of Fame selectors care about that? No, they care. They don't want to hear me talk about that any more than I want to hear them talk about stories. So the selectors don't understand technique and they're bored by it, by and large. Yeah. So what's left in the selection process is, how many Pro Bowls did he make at a time when only the players and coaches voted on the Pro Bowl? It's not seven in how long a year career, 14 year career.
Right. Yeah. And then seven all pros.
And seven all pro, where there's only one guy chosen, seven all pro, and two Pro Bowl MVPs, MVP of the game, because he controlled the special teams in an environment where in the Pro Bowl, there are no special teams players except him and guys that don't do it.
Right.
It was no contest. Absolutely no contest. They had to tell him, you can't block every kick. Don't do it. So you can't block every punt. So there was no one like him. And there's been no one like him since. Slater does not have the blocking, as good as he is, does not have the kick blocking expertise that Steve had.
You know, I mean, Bill, you know, when you think about it, you know, and I'm glad I only had to start this, and there were a lot of questions I was going to ask that you answered on your own. But when you think about it, what have you described? Extraordinary athletic ability, extraordinary intelligence, like you said, about understanding the geometry of the game and the angles, a tremendous work ethic where he practiced his craft to be better than even what he was just naturally given, you know, and an ability to do things that basically nobody else could do. So if that does not qualify somebody for the Hall of Fame, even though there aren't maybe the stats that you can cite, you know, for some of the other positions, I don't know what does. I mean, so this really, again, just calls into question, this is the greatest special teams player of all time. Does the greatest special teams player of all time deserve to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame? Yes.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. And the seven all pros are what clinch it. So there's no other argument other than, well, he's just a special teams player. And so you have to vote based upon whether you think that's an important part of the game or not. And I would, you know, when the time comes, I think, you know, I've got to make the argument along with Marv and Tony and others that really know the game that this was a guy who changed games. And there were, I wish Al Davis were alive to speak to it, because he would often tell me, you know, that Tasker, he drives us nuts. You know? Bill Parcells talks about it frequently. You know, there is no question that those that had to play against him knew that they had the game plan against him. And in most cases, they, you know, they weren't terribly successful.
Yeah. Scott normally does this at the end of the show, but, you know, if anybody wants to question this, send us your questions. But no one's going to come up with, I don't care who you are, no one, to me, is going to be able to come up with any kind of a cogent argument to say that Steve Tasker is not a Hall of Famer. Scott, you got something to say about that?
No, I mean, I would not disagree. I mean, I think the other thing is just, and we didn't talk about this, but just the mental toughness it takes to do what Steve was asked to do and to do it well at his size. Have you been around people that are tougher than Steve?
Oh, no. We haven't even, that's a good point. We haven't even talked about that. You're talking about a guy, if there are, let's say, five punts, and but by the way, he was on kickoff return too, often not as a returner, but as a blocker.
Oh, yeah.
And let's say 5 to 6 kickoffs in a game, and then however many extra points and field goals, you're talking about close to 20 plays a game, maybe more, that are high-speed car crashes.
The most violent collisions.
The most violent collisions. We put in a rule to do away with kickoff returns because the injury rate on kickoffs was three times as high as any other scrimmage play. So he's doing this for 16 games a season and then 3 more or 4 more playoff games virtually every year of his career. Without ever missing a game. I can't remember him ever missing a game.
What was his preparation like, though? I mean, I know we've talked about this with Bruce and some other guys, but to be able to do this physically, what with his athletic gifts, what did his off season and training regime look like?
Well, he was a dedicated worker. I can't remember any specific training regimen that he followed. Although he did everything that Rusty Jones wanted him to do, which was specifically prescribed for him. Rusty did individual at a time when strength and conditioning was in its infancy. Rusty was miles ahead of everybody else in terms of individual workouts and things like that. But he was just such a natural athlete that things came easy to him that no one else could do. I mean, who can do a standing backflip and land on your feet?
But then to do it 40 times, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't do that in the Olympics.
But the muscle endurance, I mean, there's a lot of guys who are strong for a short period of time, but to have that level of muscle endurance, that's got to be second to none.
Yeah, and if I'm exaggerating, it was 20, it's still incredible, you know?
And I went back and watched, we talked about his size too. I mean, I know he's listed at 5'9", 180, but when I kind of looked at him versus other players who are pretty well, I mean, that was generous, it seemed to me.
No, I think that's about right. I think, yeah, that's about right.
Well, he's not a big guy, though.
No, absolutely not. No.
So, and he's putting his body up against a lot bigger guys.
Right.
So,
And I mean, I think the other thing we didn't touch on is, and I mean, this is something I miss as a fan every week. I mean, Steve was a phenomenal broadcaster.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Who you know, got a kind of a raw deal, who should still be on Sundays.
Well, I think he does. I think he does some work for CBS still.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was a great broadcaster, brought great insight. But he's so low key and self-effacing that, well, he doesn't seek the limelight. He's not out there saying, look at me. You know, he's just, if you asked him, he's just a guy doing his job. He just did it better than anybody else in the world.
Well, and how much of that? So, I mean, this is an interesting Hall of Fame question, because if you look at kind of the list of the consensus, you know, top 10, top 15 guys who aren't in the Hall, who people think should be in the Hall, they're kind of guys like Steve, you know, the Cliff Branches of the world who might get in, you know, this next go around, or, you know, the Brian Mitchells of the world, or the Joe Jacobys of the world. These are not huge self-promoter kinds of people. How much do you think that's hurt Steve in the Hall of Fame process?
Well, I think it's much more the bias against special teams players. And now, as time has gone by, the selectors, many of the selectors don't even remember or have a clear vision of seeing him play. So, and then there is a significant minority, a vocal minority of people who say you lost 4 Super Bowls. You got too many guys in already.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
That's a phenomenal argument.
Well, I mean, it's, selectors have a right to their opinions. They may not be, you may not agree with them, but that, I mean, that's out there. So
that one feels more like alternate facts to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. Exactly. Write your own opinion, not write your own facts. I mean, if there are that many great players on the bill, first of all, and I have to say this again, the thing that they're holding against somebody, that team made 4 straight Super Bowls. No one's ever done that. That's not a negative against those guys. That's an extraordinary accomplishment.
But that's not the way, especially today, the world of the media views it. If you lose the Super Bowl, you are an afterthought. You're not, it's strange because in baseball, going all the way back to the Dodgers in the 50s, the pennant winner in the individual league who played in the World Series was considered a pennant winner. You had a ceremony to raise the pennant, the league championship.
You were a champion, yeah.
You were a champion. And even though you lost the World Series, and I think the Dodgers may have lost 7 straight, if I'm correct, before 1955.
When they beat you.
And they were still considered an outstanding team, a really great team. And they were a dominant team in the National League. with many, many
exactly
tremendous Hall of Fame players. Thanks.
Exactly. Nobody's saying that Duke Snyder doesn't deserve the Hall of Fame or Jackie Robinson.
Or Pee Wee Reese or Roy Campanella. No, no. So
sorry to me, Bill, I think you're being too kind. I think that's an absurd argument. And this is my opinion. I have a right to my opinion too. And I think their opinion is idiotic.
Well, all I'm saying is the facts are that there is a school of thought now among media that if you lose the Super Bowl, you are an afterthought.
Yeah, you're a loser.
In the case of the Kansas City Chiefs, they're not quite losers, but you know, what's all the Tampa Bay is that you lost, you got to go away. And for those of you that have not seen Four Falls of Buffalo, ESPN 30 for 30, you should watch it. It's interesting. By the time we got to the fourth Super Bowl, the vast majority of media and fans were sick of us. I wasn't there. I'd left. I was fired after the third Super Bowl. But they were sick of us. But we were the dominant team in the AFC, without question.
Yeah.
And interestingly, we lost in those four Super Bowls to Dallas twice, Washington once, and famously the New York Giants in wide right in Super Bowl 25, who were, along with San Francisco, the dominant teams in the NFC. Were there more dominant teams in the NFC? Yes, there was really only Denver and ourselves in Miami. But Miami's star had begun to wane by the time we went to the four Super Bowls. We did beat them in a championship game, but they weren't as dominant as they once were with the 72, you know, the undefeated teams and what have you.
Right.
The strength was in the NFC. But it was among those four teams. The NFC had Tampa Bay. And even the columnist in Buffalo, after the loss to Dallas in the third Super Bowl, said, I don't want to go back again. I'd rather be Tampa Bay. And I lost my mind. I mean, I had left by that time, but I think I wrote a letter to the editor or I went on somebody's show and just said that you know, this is un-American.
Right. You know? What are we doing here? And if not for Jeff Hostetler holding on to that ball, that whole thing could be different.
And maybe we don't go back. The bottom line is the Super Bowl is one game and it's kismet. A lot of times, you know, we were not the better team against the Washington Redskins. That much I will tell you. I'll concede that without question. The other three could have gone either way. And so the bottom line is that in the Super Bowl, anything can happen. But there is a mindset that says if you lose the Super Bowl, get out of the way. You know, you didn't have a great season.
You brought it up, so I feel like I sort of have to ask this question. That 91 Redskins team is a top five all-time team, right?
Well, I don't rank them, but it certainly was a dominant team. It was a great team. Great team. Yeah.
I mean, that was a scary team to play, right?
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there we go.
There he goes.
I feel like everybody always has that team like in the mid-teens or the 20s. I'd like to see that team play a couple of the all-time greats.
They were a better team than we were, that much I can tell you. No question about that. And that'll happen every now and then. I mean, we were a better team than the Bears when we played them and won in Super Bowl 41. So, you know, but the bottom line is that Steve, I think, suffers from some of that. Plus now voters are younger and they don't remember it. They don't remember it.
And the special teams bias.
Yeah.
There too.
Hopefully this will shed a little bit of light on to Steve, and we can right maybe this wrong in the next few years. All right. Well, Rick, I think you got an audible.
I do have an audible. Bill, there's sort of a general premise question here, and then I am going to call our attention to another guy who I think deserves to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They call it the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And as you explained to me off air, we don't include Canada because we, you know, they have their own Hall of Fame and so on. But there have obviously been players who played in other leagues, like the old AFL, the USFL, et cetera, who played either a majority or all their careers in, who are not in. In fact, the only person who never played in the NFL among modern players who's in is Billy Shaw, who's played for the Bills. Bill, I want to bring up the name Cookie Gilchrist. To me, in my mind, and I'm even going to say statistics or anything, but I was a little kid when I watched him, but I mean, he was so much bigger than everybody, wasn't seen to me in terms of running backs. Fast. He ran, you know, with bad intent. He kicked for them. He both field goals and extra points. I mean, to me, he was a dominant player. He was a great running back. Does he deserve to be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I don't know that I'd answer. I don't know that I can say whether he deserves or doesn't deserve to be in. First of all, he was a latter day Marcus Dupree. Came right out of high school and went to the Canadian League and was a force in the Canadian League.
But before that, Paul Brown tried to get him out of high school into the NFL, and the NFL shot him down.
Yes, the NFL would not give him any eligibility. So he went to Canada instead and became a force in Canada. And then in 1960, when the AFL was born, the Buffalo Bills signed him. And he became a star in Buffalo for a Buffalo Bills team that won an AFL championship. And the tagline was, looky, looky, here comes Cookie. He was a genuine, genuine star. and then... in a situation that repeated itself with Joe Cribbs at a later time, he asked for a new contract. I don't know what the particulars were. I never spoke with Mr. Wilson about it. I've spoken with lots of his teammates, including Jack Kemp, who believes, like you, that he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, believed, the late Jack Kemp. So he left the Bills and went back to Canada. And I'm sure he's in the CFL Hall of Fame. But because his career in the AFL was relatively short, as opposed to Billy Shaw, who played a long time in the AFL, every year of the AFL, or George Blanda, who played every year of the AFL, he's not a consideration. I mean, he's kind of a, if people even think about him, he's an afterthought. He was never considered as part of the, you know, the 100 greatest players of all time, for example. So he's not really on anybody's front burner. And because the CFL has its own Hall of Fame, which, by the way, Marv Levy will be going into this coming December at the Grey Cup in Hamilton. Who would have thought that Marv Levy, who won 4 Grey Cups in Montreal, was not in the Hall of Fame?
Right. I didn't know that. Right.
I didn't know it either until they called me and said, would you please help, you know, on his candidacy? So the bottom line is that the CFL has its own Hall of Fame. So unless the player comes in and reestablishes his identity as a candidate, a bona fide candidate in the NFL, he really doesn't have a chance. Flutie being the perfect example of that. Doug Flutie had a really nice career in the NFL, but not a Hall of Fame career, and he did have a Hall of Fame career in Canada. So that's just the nature of things. That's the answer.
There you go, Rick. That's how the cookie crumbles.
If you groan.
There we go. Well,
that is a bad one to end on.
Yeah, Bill, are we going to even talk to Scott next week? I don't know.
You have another audible that we can escape from that one.
I think we put my many Brian Mitchell questions we get all the time at the front. So,
well, let me end on that so we don't end on that, the worst of all.
Puns. All right, so here we go. So, is Brian Mitchell a Hall of Famer? Yay or nay?
He certainly is a viable candidate, and Devin Hester is now eligible this year. And so that discussion, I think, will take place. I think that will take place. And from my own personal point of view, taking nothing away from Hester, I don't think you're going to get two returners, guys who were principally returners, in the Hall anytime soon. So, I mean, my choice would be Mitchell, I think. And the numbers tell you that.
Well, I think that's a happy one to end on. So hopefully, sometime in the next few years, we will have B. Mitch in the Hall of Fame, which would make all of us very happy. All right. Well, if you like puns, get ready, because we've got more for next week as we dive into Reggie Wayne and we make the case, which I think is going to be a pretty easy one, but it'll be interesting to see Bill's take on a lot of subjects in terms of wide receiver criteria and those kinds of things, which we haven't gotten into. So if you've got any questions for us, hit us up on Twitter at IFBillPolian, and we'll be sure to include it. Hey, Rick, you go use that haircut well today.
All right, man. Anybody you want me to cheer for it in the BMW, Scott?
I would like you just to be safe. That's all right. I care.
I will do that. Thank you.
Tony, see now one, so I don't have to, he broke his maiden. So
exactly.
We're good.
All is right with the world. All right. Well, have fun and get ready for a really fun one next week as we get into Reggie Wayne. Thank you guys.
All right. Thank you. Everybody. Take care. Stay safe.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.